Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Retail sales fell more than 16 percentage points in April. That was the largest drop on record, nearly doubling the previous record-breaking plunge in March. That's according to the U.S. Commerce Department. Retailers that depend on foot traffic are feeling the most pain. Macy's predicts roughly $1 billion in operating losses by July 1st, when its financials are due. Columbus-based L Brands plans to close about 1 in 4 Victoria's Secret and Pink stores in North America, and Pier 1 is going out of business. Nationwide protests pose different challenges. We're talking about all that post-pandemic retail, all the issues associated with that today. Lee Peterson is a Executive Vice President of Thought Leadership and Marketing at Dublin-based WD Partners. That's a consulting firm that specializes in retail customer experience. Welcome to the show, Lee.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
And Chuck Palmer is owner and principal strategist at ConsumerX. That's a retail consultancy in Columbus. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
So, Chuck, a retail drop-off of more than 16%. Can you put that into context? How does that compare to a bad quarter?
That's a good question. I think that it is, you know, a huge decrease, but frankly, when I saw those numbers, I thought it could have been worse, and I think that is a testament to e-commerce business and how some of the essential businesses, grocery and the multi-category retailers like Walmart and Target, maintain their businesses, even with some restrictions in some states where they weren't allowed to sell non-essential things. Comparatively, I'm surprised it wasn't worse. But it is a stunning number, of course.
And Lee Peterson, not only do we have this stunning number to cope with, but it's not going back. Pardon me. It's not like going back to business as usual either as the reopening begins.
Yeah. And I think one of the first things we have to remember about this pandemic is that it wasn't or is not a disruptor. It's an accelerator. And it has been an accelerator. So, you know, to Chuck's point, you saw e-com sales kind of off the chart, the hockey sticking before this. And now they're unbelievable, like a huge percentage. And a lot of us are talking about how the pandemic has caused a tipping point for online sales to go over 50% compared to store sales. Mall traffic was down before the pandemic, and now it's pretty much non-existent for a lot of reasons. But, in our discussions with consumers, I'm not sure that they're going to go back anywhere near the magnitude that they were, let's say, January, February, December. Amazon was off the charts. Department stores were not doing well before the pandemic. So really what took place just accelerated what was already going on for a long period of time.
It feels like an Escher drawing in a way where the hands are drawing themselves into something different. It wasn't expected, but it accelerated at a time. Was the system ready for it, Chuck?
You know, that's a good question. I think that we were, as retail as a whole, was experimenting with a lot of different things and starting to see some traction with things like buy online, pick up in store, and the behavior was starting to catch up with that. This is one of the cases where some retailers were playing around with lots of different kinds of technologies and different methodologies to see what would work, and the ones that were sticking were starting to get implemented more widely. And to Lee's point, this has accelerated the behavior. If you think about the fact that we've been sort of like on pause for 3 months, then you have this sort of moment where people are really considering and really thinking through the decisions they're making about spending money and how they're going to do it, because there's this health concern associated with it. So if there are options to do that, you know, there were widespread reports of, you know, 2 week, 3 week wait times for grocery delivery slots,
uh-huh.
right? That I'm sure, put off a lot of people. I know I tried a few times in a few different ways, because I was using that, the services prior to the pandemic, just from a convenience standpoint. But when you're sort of forced into it, it's a very different mindset. It's sort of like you have to. So it is sort of what happened with the panic buying right up front around toilet mm-hmm. paper and hand sanitizer, right? Those things were like, there's something visceral about what was happening, and people reacted to it that way, and they jumped on those slots. They didn't want to leave the house, et cetera.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about, I can't really say post-pandemic, but amid the pandemic, how retail sales are managing. How retail outlets are surviving or not. My guest, you just heard Chuck Palmer. He's an owner and principal strategist at Consumer X Retail. That's a retail consultant firm in Columbus. And also with us, Lee Peterson. He's executive vice president of thought leadership and marketing at WD Partners in Dublin. I would love to hear from listeners about where you're going to shop now. Are you going out? If you are going out, what do you expect the circumstances will be? Where are you going? Obviously, we all have to get our groceries, but beyond that, the non-essential places are opening. Are you going out? And if you are, why? 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, Lee Peterson, what do we know about the people? I see photos of people lining up to go into sports stores and things like that. What are people going out for?
Well, one thing has become very clear over the course of the last couple of months, and that is discounters, who were mostly deemed essential, but the fact that they were selling lower priced goods, and even the big guys like Walmart, Target, Costco, those guys had stellar performances. And they not only had stellar performances in the stores, but they also did with e-commerce. Target had something like 141% increase in their e-commerce. And Walmart, who was set up to do buy online, pick up in store about 2 years ago, they had over 1,000 stores in position to do that. Just, their business was off the charts. But, so was Amazon as well. Even with the delays, that Chuck was referring to, their business was up 24% for the quarter. Yeah. And as Les Wexner taught me, that's a big number on a big number. Mm-hmm. And so I think consumers, and again, those guys were already doing pretty well. And with this event, their sales, their performance, the things that they had executed and prepared for, really put them over the top and made them number one choices for consumers. I think, Chuck was talking about it, but grocery stores as well. And, I didn't really try the online version of grocery stores. And I think, but the grocery stores and the way that they adjusted to everything, with the lines on the floors, with aisles going certain mm-hmm. ways, with everybody having to wear a mask and passing out masks at the front door, I think was really kind of a foretell of the way that retail should be done in the future.
Hmm. Yeah, I did do the online stuff and was disillusioned when I got an ultralight beer instead of a Molson. So, for some crazy reason, someone thought that was a good substitute.
There's a lot of work to be done there on the customer service and satisfaction part of that. Because when you're actually making those selections physically in real time, mm-hmm. you make those decisions. I was just asked by a journalist the other day about the future of browsing, and it really challenged me to think about, because we are breaking everything down, everything is on the table and we're rethinking everything. And the idea of being able to browse something, but not pick it up. Mm-hmm. I'm not seeing that a lot. I think the fears of picking up the virus from a can of soup in a store or having it delivered are diminishing, but there are some people who are continuing that behavior of cleaning those things and wiping them down just to be safe. They have either they have real or future state concerns about those kinds of transmission, and the health part of this becomes a new factor for a lot of people, right? Because prior to this, we just shopped. We just did what we did, and we didn't have to think about it, let alone putting on a mask or wiping down the cart. So I think that there's this this has pushed us down the sort of hierarchy of needs, and I don't know that we still are, but at one point we were just, you know, we were worried about toilet paper and hand sanitizer and getting food and paying our rent, right? And now I think to your question, people are starting to sort of like pop their heads up again. And because we have our government saying that it's okay to open things, we're seeing behaviorally people are doing that. They're going out to bars, they're going to restaurants, but not in mass, not in the way that they were pre-pandemic level. So that's going to take time for both the retailers and brands, restaurants, et cetera, to demonstrate that they're being responsible to bring back the full load, because I think the majority of people haven't forgotten what this thing can do and what those fears are. As much as it's, you know, hell, it hasn't rained in a few days, so we're all sort of excited just to be outside, right?
Yeah.
I know I am.
Exactly. Lee Peterson, what about, everything I've been reading about how retailers are responding to this going forward, you know, the plexiglass barriers, masks, sanitation tables, you know, with hand sanitizers and all kind of masks and that kind of a thing. There is a certain segment of the buying public that resists all of that. Where is there going to be a push and a shove coming up?
I don't think so. I think, it obviously depends on the retailer. Like Costco had a policy where no mask, no service.
Right.
And you probably saw the viral videos of them actually asking people to leave that didn't have masks on.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think a lot of cases, people don't really understand the mask theory that we all have to do it or it doesn't really apply. And I think the airlines are about to discover that too. But I think I've been in malls now two or three times, and one of the things that struck me was it wasn't that different. I went into an Abercrombie store as an example, and the merchandise was spaced out a little bit different. They did not have plexiglass up in their cash wrap. The employees had masks on.
Mm-hmm.
They would show you something, and you kind of had to shop yourself. But I found the experience pretty similar, really. Grocery to me was a big change, and some of the big box guys were a pretty big change too that might last for a long time. But I wouldn't see in specialty, where the experience is more important, really sort of demolishing their stores and changing the way that customers behave as much as other areas. I thought one of the things that was interesting that came out over the course of the last couple of weeks is that the companies that are opening stores, like American Eagle opened 300 plus some stores, and those stores did 95% of the business that they had done last year. So,
wow.
So really their business was not that far off. Whereas Gap was somewhere 65, 70%, and they opened 1500 stores. So customers made a choice while they had the time off, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And while they had some pent up frustration for certain brands, they immediately went to the brands that were most important to them so far.
Mm-hmm. We will continue our conversation. We're talking about the future of retail post-pandemic, and we'll also talk about kind of that double whammy of the protests and the impact that's had with the curfews and so forth, although the curfew in Columbus has been called off now. So I'd like to hear from listeners. Are you out there shopping yet? If so, where, why? And if not, why? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Victoria's Secret and JCPenney, among the largest and hardest hit retail chains in the pandemic-related economic downturn, are closing hundreds of their U.S. stores. Small retailers are hurting too, and both large and small are rethinking how their customers experience the stores to minimize the spread of COVID-19. Still with us, Chuck Palmer, owner and principal strategist at ConsumerX, a retail consultancy in Columbus, and Lee Peterson, executive vice president of thought leadership and marketing at Dublin-based WD Partners. That's a consulting firm that specializes in retail customer experience. Roger Geiger is a vice president and the Ohio executive director for the National Federation of Independent Business. Welcome to the show, Roger.
Thank you, Ann, for having me.
NFIB surveyed members in Ohio about how the coronavirus and the reopening of the economy are affecting them. What stood out to you in their responses?
Well, a couple things, Ann. As NFIB is the state's largest small business advocacy organization. We have about 22,000 members here in Ohio. We cut all of the small business community. So my perspective is really from the small retailers and small business owners. A couple things that were pretty dramatic. One is there isn't a small business owner out there that wasn't impacted. And this was a pretty dramatic challenge for small businesses. Even those that were able to stay open, and probably the statistic that's most surprising to me is that almost 70% of small businesses stayed open through this. And I really give a lot of credit to the governor for his creative, what he called essential businesses at the time. I don't like that term because I think all businesses are essential. But he created a definition, unlike other governors around the country, that really allowed for not only businesses that we think of providing essential services like grocery stores and pharmacies, but businesses that also were essential to those essential businesses. The pallet maker who builds pallets for Procter & Gamble, who ships bleach, is a good example. And then the creativity of allowing businesses to work from home. Our neighboring state, Pennsylvania, didn't allow that to happen. And so I think that was probably the most stunning statistic. But clearly, of those that didn't stay open, it was devastating. And obviously, we know the majority of those were small retailers, small restaurant owners, small bars that were really, really impacted because they had to shut their doors for almost 3 months. And unlike big businesses that we've talked about, the big box stores, the big chain stores, small businesses only have about 2 months of liquidity, and they don't have access to lots of capital. And so clearly the government, the federal government programs that were real critical lifelines to small businesses, we had almost 130,000 small businesses in this state who got about $18 billion in the federal loan program.
Yeah.
But were really critical to their survivability.
What about those loans, though? Will they come due or will enough of them be granted forgiveness on them?
Well, there, as you know, there were two programs. There was the EIDL program, the Economic Injury Disaster Loan Program, and then there was the more popular one, which was the Paycheck Protection Program, which was really designed to try to encourage small business owners to keep their employees on their payroll. That's where the majority of the money that was loaned was. The idea was to, even if you were shuttered or even if you didn't have full service, you weren't operating at full capacity, that you kept those employees engaged. And quite frankly, even as staggering as our unemployment numbers were and still are, with over 600,000 Ohioans on unemployment, it could have been even more dramatic had it not been for those programs keeping folks employed. And it was a very clunky rollout. There were some misintended provisions that are in there that we're still going to have to get through. One of them is the time frame in terms of the forgiveness. Now, Congress just extended that, which was important. When you think about it, almost 200,000 small businesses were able to take advantage of that here in Ohio. The ability to extend unemployment for the first time to the self-employed. People don't realize that we have almost 600,000 self-employed Ohioans, the folks who work for themselves. So the ability for the first time for them to be able to collect the 1099 individuals, to be able to collect unemployment was significant as well. So the good news in all of this is small businesses are resilient. They are the first to suffer in any economic downturn. They are the first to go, but they're also the very first to come back. Economic recovery has always in this country been not decided by what's happening on Wall Street. It's about the number of small businesses that are starting up, that are expanding, that are reopening. That's the key, and that's what we're right in. You know, we're at the beginning of that. You know, many hope that this is what's called a V curve. Most recessions, there's fundamentals that are wrong in the economy, and it takes a period of time. It's a bubble in the economy. There's inflation. There are fundamentals that are wrong. There was really not much that was wrong in the fundamentals of our economy. This was a sheer cliff. I mean, literally, if you look at the first 2 weeks of March and you look at the second 2 weeks of March, you would have thought you were in completely different years in terms of the economy. It literally was a cliff.
Well, Lee Peterson brought up something. Chuck Palmer echoed it. The question of whether the pandemic was a disruptor or an accelerator. You know, when it comes to big businesses, when it comes to e-commerce, I get that. What about small businesses? Are more of them going online? Is it going to accelerate something among small business owners?
Well, there's no question. I agree that there's been fundamental changes in the economy that's quite frankly allowing small businesses to do things that they've never done before. The whole gig economy. You know, who thought that you could make a living off of being an Uber driver? You're a self-employed individual.
Yeah.
And you're using technology to do that. You can be in the international trade world online as a very small retailer. So it has been and it is continuing to change. But at the end of the day, for small businesses, they are still the backbone of every community in this state. They are literally the number one employers of jobs. We like to talk about the big box stores and the big manufacturers, but at the end of the day, it is small businesses who employ a vast majority of Ohioans, particularly non-government jobs. It is small businesses who are allowing for minority and women businesses to get into private ownership. That's the fastest growing segment of the small business community, which will dovetail into your next conversation. The small businesses have always been able to be resilient and adapt. That's what sets them apart from their larger counterparts. They are much more creative, and they have the ability to adapt quickly. And we're seeing that. Just as the big retailers are changing their way of doing business, small businesses have always been doing that, always trying to find that niche, always trying to find that competitive advantage. And, for small business owners, the two most important assets, if you will, are their customers and their employees. A small business owner cannot exist without the two of those. So they treasure both of that. They treasure customer experience. They want to make sure customers feel safe. So they are adapting just like you see in the big box stores. I would argue that probably even better so. I always, one of my conundrums in this was to watch literally hundreds and hundreds of people flock into a big box store to buy a lot of items that you could buy at small retailers and they were shut down. At the same time, if they had been open, they may have had five or six people in their store at any one time. You know, a small furniture store, a small carpet store, a small retailer, you know, a small clothing store, and probably could have handled all of the social distancing, all of the cleanliness, all of those kinds of things. So that was, I think, one of the lessons that we're going to, if we unfortunately go through this again, hopefully not in our lifetime, I think will be one of the lessons that we've learned is that we got to be careful about creating the perception that only big operations can succeed and do these things.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the future of retail, how it's changed, maybe in some cases forever. What will bounce back, what won't, after the pandemic or amid the pandemic. COVID-19 is still with us. If you have a question or comment, give us a call. I'd like to hear from listeners about their shopping experiences so far. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Barb in Worthington, you're on the air. Hi, Barb.
Oh, hi. Yeah, I just wanted to comment on my surprise at so many unmasked employees in grocery stores.
Really?
I mean, they have the plexiglass. They have the signs up about social distancing. They have, you know, X's marked in different places. And the employees are all technically wearing a mask, but half of them it's around their neck or maybe down under their nose. And I mean literally half in some of these grocery stores. So I'm just surprised at the lack of, I don't know. I mean, I think they must have a policy that all employees are supposed to wear masks, or at least all inside employees, but nobody's paying attention.
But they're not policing it very well. You know, I think, Lee Peterson, you brought that up earlier, that it's going to be, you know, that it does set a tone when you walk into a store, whether you want to stay. For most people, right, is how people are being protected.
Yeah, and I can tell you, Barb, maybe you should shop at Whole Foods because they're 100% masked all the time. And, you know, a lot of people call it Whole Paycheck, but if you shop the 365 brand, it's not that much more expensive than Kroger. You should probably check it out if you don't feel safe. But, yeah, I think the other thing that I saw Whole Foods doing that maybe more grocers on a larger scale should get into is they were passing out masks. I just personally received from Amazon 100 masks. If I can get 100 masks, I'm pretty sure that Kroger and Giant Eagle could get a 1,000 masks if they really wanted to, and they're not that expensive. So I think to pass them out and to have it on employees is essential for, you know, the perception of from a consumer, do I want to go in there? I mean, think, Barb, of what you're thinking about. And then also from one employee to the other. I think it's like a travesty that people think that wearing a mask is a bad thing at all. And also not understanding the idea that unless we all wear masks, it really doesn't matter.
You know, I'm thinking about the difference between an Amazon organization like Whole Foods, Kroger, Costco, any of the big guys and the small guys. I mean, it's one thing to get, the masks, the decent masks aren't that cheap. And Roger Geiger, the smaller outfits, do they have the economies of scale to provide things like masks at the door and that kind of a thing, or the margins to tell people, I'm sorry, you can't come in if you're not wearing a mask.
Well, and I will tell you, in the last month and a half, I've learned more about facial coverings, which is the proper term, because when you use the word mask, that has legal connotations, and the rule requires facial coverings.
Okay.
So I've learned more about the use of masks than I ever thought I would, or facial coverings than I ever thought I would.
Right.
And let me just make a couple of observations. Of the five protocols, it is the most difficult one for small employers and probably all employers to do for a number of reasons. And yet there's the science out there that suggests that of the five, it's important, but it is clearly not as important as washing your hands and disinfecting and creating guards.
And distancing.
Yeah, and distancing. Distancing is the number one. You know, as you know, you've got to really have a projectile that enters through your face to really have a risk. And so, of the five protocols, while important, it's the least effective, and it is the most difficult one. And as one of your previous guests have already mentioned, unless both sides are doing it, and without a requirement that all Ohioans do it, it becomes even less effective. So the customer doesn't have to do it, but the employee does, which is, first of all, makes you wonder, okay, where's the logic of that? Because effectiveness of face coverings is only if both parties have it on.
It depends. Roger, that's...
The second issue is there are a lot of scenarios where a mask becomes more problematic. And again, I'm just telling you that there's, you know, for an example, if you're in a restaurant, if you're in a food processing part of a grocery store, the last thing you want is somebody to have a dirty mask on, because there's all kinds of other infection problems that you have, and there are safety issues about masks. If you are over a hot object, or if you've got something that could get caught in a processing thing. So there are lots of reasons why you may not be wearing a mask in certain settings. There are legitimate exemptions that are created in the rule that allow for certain workers not to have masks.
And I get all that, Roger, but I'm just talking about the person who walks through the door. What's the sense? I mean, what should people expect?
I think your previous guest mentioned it. I think in small businesses, I think you're going to find it far more common because of their desire to, one, it's easier to police, if you will, when you have four employees versus 250 employees. You certainly can be able to create a lot more guidelines that are enforceable in your enterprise than maybe some of your larger counterparts can do. Again, as I mentioned earlier, the most important thing that a small business can do that wants to be successful, and I have yet to meet a small business owner who doesn't want to be successful, is make sure that the customer is comfortable. The biggest concern small business owners have right now is, will customers come back? That is the number one issue right now confronting every small business owner. Will I get my customers back? And that is based on two things. One, based on safety. Does the customer feel safe coming into that enterprise? And two, are they willing to spend money? Those are the two biggest issues that small business owners right now are the most concerned about. Okay. So small business owners that are going to be successful and come through this successfully are going to pay attention to those safety protocols.
We are talking about retail coming back from the shutdown. If you have a question or comment, love to hear from people about why you're going out to stores now, why you're not. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the post-pandemic future of retail in the U.S. Still with us, Chuck Palmer, owner and principal strategist at ConsumerX, retail consultancy in Columbus. Lee Peterson, executive vice president of thought leadership and marketing at WD Partners in Dublin. And Roger Geiger, vice president and the Ohio executive director for the National Federation of Independent Business. If you have we've got some callers now who want to talk about their shopping experiences. But before we move on to that, I'm wondering, Chuck Palmer, if you can talk about the big versus the little. Are consumers more forgiving with smaller independent operations than they are with, say, a Costco?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I did a bit of a very unscientific survey of my friends and connections on LinkedIn and Facebook, and consistently those that responded were saying, I want to support the small businesses that I like. And frankly, I think it comes down to, if I'm going to venture out, if I'm going to spend some money that, you know, if I'm going to have an egg sandwich for breakfast that I don't make myself, mm-hmm. I want it to be a really good one, one of my favorites. And a lot of those small businesses, to Roger's point, flexed and they did some really interesting things quickly. Some of them even like closed for a week or two to regroup and reset. And I think that consumers appreciate that. And this is, you know, to my earlier point about sort of pushing us down the hierarchy, we're more focused on things that hold both economic health and social concerns all at once, right? And when, you know, this weekend, I made it a point to seek out Links and Lemonade in Graceland, because I've heard their hot dogs are amazing and the lemonade is great. And they're black owned and operated. It was definitely worth the time and money and the mask that I had to wear to go in and order and stand and wait, because it was really good. You know, I can't get that from I don't know if there's a hot dog chain out there, but you know what I mean? I think people are have the time to be more thoughtful about those decisions now.
Violette in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Violette.
Hi, Anne.
Go ahead.
Yes, I want to talk about my experience this past Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
I went to Walmart, and to my surprise, they closed at 5 o'clock.
Yeah.
I was like, oh. Mm. So that was a huge shock for me, because Walmart, 24-hour Walmart closing at 5 o'clock,
yeah.
I think Walmart basically hit with a double whammy with social distancing,
mm-hmm.
And then the rioting that has been going on. So, but I can tell you about my experience towards the social distancing before they start closing their doors at 5 o'clock. I think Walmart is ahead of the game.
How so?
When it comes, they have quartered off, like when you first walk into the store, they have sections off going inside the store. So, you know, their workers are covered with masks.
Mm-hmm.
They are monitoring their customers, trying to give them the best optimized experience in the store with the social distancing. And then when I, like, go up to the counters and stuff like that, I notice that they space out the customers.
They space them out. They keep them farther away from the thing. And
yeah.
Just, Violette, before I let you go, I mean, did you like this feeling when you come in? You like to feel safe. You like what you're seeing.
Yes.
Okay.
And let me just say this, Anne.
Uh-huh.
One store that topped them all to me, I went to Kohl's.
Kohl's, okay.
Kohl's. And they have it even better.
Hmm.
That the worker have a line that the customer's standing in, and they are actually moving the customers to a register themselves. So not only are you standing in the line where there's social distancing, but there's a worker that's telling each customer which line
to go in.
To go in.
Yeah.
And it's actually not it's actually moving faster.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And so I call because if I come in there with my mask on and they have their mask on,
yeah.
Like that's It's effective and efficient.
Yeah. Well, Violetta, thank you so much for calling. I appreciate it.
Thank you for the topic.
You bet. You know, I think she brings up a really interesting question about the odd hours. Thoughts about that, Lee Peterson?
Well, I think everybody did it initially to protect their employees. And, until they got a hand of it, all essential businesses were open instead of 24-hour. I mean, Giant Eagle and all the way down Target, Walmart, reduced their hours to protect their employees. And also, I think to kind of get a handle on exactly how the customer was going to shop, you know, that online and then buy online, pick up in store skyrocketed so much for them. That became a larger priority than actually keeping your store open for a while. So I think that you're going to see that sort of evolve back into regular hours pretty quick here.
Yeah, and this is no concerns too. The just restocking when, you know, if you think about those first few weeks, the inventory management issue was huge, right? And things were, you know, shelves were getting decimated, and they also had to be cleaned. And so there is this, I have noticed sort of, we're all used to sort of stores close at 8 or 9, and, you know, there's this sort of standards around that. And now those standards are kind of all over the place. You're not sure when the place that you want to go to is going to be open or not.
Right, right.
It's getting back to normal, I think, of whatever normal is going to look like in the future. But to your caller's, you know, dismay, you know, you're like Walmart on a Saturday night.
Right.
You know, you could spend a few hours getting your stuff done when it may not be as busy as maybe other times. And they close at 5, you're surprised, right? And so that is that has happened. And I think that we're, you know, as consumers, we need to be a little bit more flexible. But it'll level out here soon once operations get back into sync.
If I may age myself here, let your fingers do the walking for a few more months because you just don't know, and you should call first, right?
Yeah. Okay. I don't even know. Do stores answer their phones? I don't even know.
or go online. Yeah. Let's see. Catherine in New Bremen, you're on the air. You're right, New Bremen, Catherine?
I am, Anne. Good morning.
Good morning.
So cool. I was calling just in regards to the gentleman from the NFIB and just giving some personal statistics. I have 2 specialty toy stores, one in Auglaize County and one in Miami County. And we depend on our walk-in customers. Our whole business is based on walking in, touching, and having an authentic experience with customers, especially children. So the shutdown was painful. But the reason I called was in regards to, first, the PPL loan possible grants. That was a quick and easy process. The banks were, you know, posting those before the SBA could even, you know, get past all the rigmarole. And that was a gift to my 14 part-time employees who didn't work for 9 weeks, for me to be able to say, I still value you and we want this experience to continue.
Mm-hmm.
So fingers crossed that that's going to all follow through and those grants are going to come through. But I guess in general, I just wanted to talk about the small business and the true impact that it's made.
Well, Catherine, best wishes. Issue of particularly things like toy stores and stuff like that was brought up in, I think, a New York Times article that I looked at to prepare for the show. There are certain kinds of businesses, are there not, Chuck Palmer, that are particularly affected, that our habits are really going to change?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we're seeing sort of standard behavior around in grocery stores and stuff. But when it comes to specialty stores, there's going to be real questions and how, you know, as the science comes out, as we learn more about the virus and can validate some of the new findings, you know, we're maybe going to be seeing an easing off of these restrictions. But that doesn't mean consumers are going to be fully comfortable with that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, as we sort of move up the hierarchy of needs, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm seeing people talk about things that are really discretionary. You know, like, you know, going out for a meal is becoming like the new like treat, right? Whereas for a lot of us, it was, you know, it was just a normal thing on a daily basis. But as you know, we're talking about toy stores or gift stores and those sorts of things. That, you know, I could see retailers maintaining an appointment only situation. I hope that they're looking at this as an opportunity to deepen their relationships with their customers while they're not in the store. You know, that as much as you want to engage people when they're walking in, but capturing information and their interest while they're there and maintaining that through social media or email marketing or whatever, I think it's got to be critical for those smaller businesses. Because our loyalties, our behaviors are so disrupted these days.
Yeah.
And they're, you know, I try as much as I possible not to use the term normal, because retail has not been normal for quite some time.
That's
it's
right.
been in flux. And you know, even the idea of a disruption is just seems absurd. It's just today's chaos, right? And and so we, you know, we have to be nimble. We have to remain like thinking about what those core ideas are that are critical to our businesses and our relationships with our customers and our staff. And you know, to the small business owner who just called, mm-hmm. you know, embracing those people when they are in the store, getting, you know, telling the stories of their staff and sharing that kind of information and why they love that store and why they love those mm-hmm. merchandise is part of the meaning that people seek when they go out and spend money now. I mean, experience is really based on something that is significantly meaning to an individual.
I want to grab a quick call with Josh from Columbus here. Josh, you own two retail stores and you're not reopening. What's going on?
Yeah, that's right. Hey, Ann, how you doing?
Good.
So,
hi, Josh.
Hey, guys, how are you? I do know Chuck and Lee. We closed about 10 days in advance of the state-mandated closure.
Wow.
We did not feel comfortable at that point. We tried having fairly restricted environments in terms of capacity and masks and that sort of thing, and still didn't feel comfortable. So I've honestly struggled with reconciling my feelings at that point, knowing our case count at this point.
Is there something particular about the kind of business you're in, Josh, that there's a lot of touchy-feely stuff? Or?
Yeah, so I'll kind of echo a lot of what Catherine said. I own one children's store,
okay,
which is a very high-touch environment that's
yeah.
difficult to monitor. And then I own a men's and women's store as well that okay. is pretty large. We carry a lot of gift, and that store needs 200 to 300 bodies a day to walk in, and people will spend 45 minutes to an hour in.
Gotcha.
And so that business model doesn't really work right now. We have removed a significant amount of our apparel and shifted towards things like games and puzzles and backyard activities. But for us, we've shifted all the power of both engines over to e-com, in-store pickup, and added local delivery. And I'd really encourage a lot of other local retailers to consider
mm-hmm.
that right now, because I think people are going to be struggling to try and prop up a business model that I fear isn't going to be relevant for a while as people struggle to reenter the economy. And so as Chuck spoke about, figuring out how to strengthen your relationship with your existing customer base so that they're still there for you and you're still serving them in any way.
Mm-hmm.
And figuring out how to say, this is a seismic shift in the independent retail landscape. We realize now that there is a place for independent retail and e-com that maybe wasn't there before.
Mm-hmm.
And how do we bolster those experiences and tell stories in a way that independent retailers, I think, have suffered and not really understood how to do in the past? Because I think if there's a second wave of the pandemic or
yeah.
people have just shifted their behaviors to largely e-com, how do you meet those needs in a different way? And then what does the physical space that you own do?
Josh, thank you so much for calling. I appreciate it. Thanks for listening. We're out of time. I want to thank my guests, Roger Geiger, Vice President and Ohio's Executive Director at the National Federation of Independent Business. Roger, thank you so much for your time today.
You bet.
And Chuck Palmer, owner and principal strategist at Consumer X Retail, a retail consultant firm in Columbus. Thank you so much, Chuck.
Thank you, Ann. Always a pleasure.
Also, Lee Peterson, Executive Vice President of Thought Leadership and Marketing at WD Partners in Dublin. Thank you so much, Lee.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks to everybody for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.